there's a huge study which was done in 2023 by Gallup and tens of thousands of people, and they estimate the cost of disengagement in organizations to be $8.8 trillion a year. Now, that's disengagement, and the other big cost, of course, is poor communication. If people aren't listening at work, and this is not just leaders, this would be across teams, there's miscommunication, there is misunderstanding, there's conflict, and the cost of poor communication is estimated to be around a day a week per person working. Another $1.2 trillion a year.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Aspire to Inspire podcast. My name is Lottie Baisley, Internal Communications Manager at Staffbase. And today's guest is someone whose voice quite literally has changed the way the world thinks about communication. Julian Treasure is a globally renowned speaker, author, and advisor on the art and science of listening and speaking. With 5 TED Talks, including the 6th most viewed of all time, Julian has reached over 150 million people with his message about the power of sound in business and in life. As the founder of the Listening Society and Julian Treasure Limited, he works with CEOs, teams, and event leaders to elevate how people communicate, whether on stage, in the boardroom, or through brand experiences. In this episode, we will explore why listening is one of the most underdeveloped leadership skills, how sound influences behavior and culture, and what leaders can do to recover when things go sideways in public. Julian, welcome to the Aspire to Inspire podcast. It's an honor to have you with us today.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you, Lottie.
Of course. Thank you so much. So before I get into it, I just wanted to check, have you done your vocal warm-ups?
Of course.
I also did some after having watched the TED Talk. There's no pressure now. I'm doing a podcast on speaking and listening, so no pressure at all. Are you happy for us to get straight in?
Of course, yes, please.
Fab. So you have spoken and written extensively about listening as an active skill, and have just released a book that explores the kind of profound impact of sound on every aspect of our lives. And you did kindly send us a sneak peek last week, which I did have a little read of over the weekend. And I've since been doing some intentional listening, so kind of noticing all the individual sounds I'm hearing at once. So let's start there then. What do you think most leaders still get wrong about listening? And why is that such a critical miss in today's workplace?
Well, let me answer this the other way around, because it's important to understand that listening is crucial in all our relationships. Mm-hmm. So this is universal. This is at home just mm-hmm. as much as at work. It's very, very important for leadership as well. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's the research shows that most leaders are not great at it. In fact, mm-hmm. only 8% of people in a very big study rated their leaders as very good at listening. So wow. There's a lot of people out there who are leading, but not particularly good at listening. Now, mm-hmm. why would that be? Because most people don't even realize that listening is a skill. Mm-hmm. It's conflated and confused with hearing, which we do automatically. So hearing is a capability. We all do that, although 1 in 4 of the world's population has got damaged hearing, sadly, and there mm-hmm. are many millions of young people joining those ranks now because of headphone abuse. So that's a really big problem. But let's leave that aside for the moment. We hear, it's automatic. Sound enters your ears. There's nothing you can do about it. It's as automatic as your heart beating. You've been doing it since you were in your mother's womb. Hearing is the first sense that you develop. And of course, the mother's heartbeat is the first thing we experience. And it's also our primary warning sense, because you can hear what's behind you and mm-hmm. you can hear the dark. And the eyes don't mm-hmm. work in either of those two situations. So hearing goes very deep, very fast. But listening is different. Listening is where you select certain things to pay attention to, and then you make them mean something. Mm-hmm. So my definition of listening is making meaning from sound. And you can take that on, of course, into a more full definition of listening, which involves responding to the other person, analyzing what they're saying. If it's a conversation, this is of course, and, you know, responding effectively and letting the person know they're heard and responded to and so forth. It's a complex process. It's not a capability. It's a skill. It's work. And if it's not taken seriously as a skill, which in most organizations it isn't. So everyone listening to this, ask yourself, do we train on listening? Do we have a question about listening in our 360s? You know, how good is this person at listening? Do we reward good listeners? It's taken for granted. And actually, the research shows that as a result of this kind of numbness, this disregarding of the power of the skill of listening, leadership lacks it a great deal. And we're seeing two things resulting from that. One is disconnection, disengagement, because teams who aren't listened to don't feel engaged. And the cost is absolutely astronomical of that. There's a huge study which was done in 2023 by Gallup and tens of thousands of people. And they estimate the cost of disengagement in organizations to be $8.8 trillion a year.
Wow.
$8.8 trillion. That's non-trivial. Now, that's disengagement. And the other big cost, of course, is poor communication. You know, if people aren't listening at work, and this is not just leaders, this would be across teams, you know, there's miscommunication, there is misunderstanding, there's conflict. And the cost of poor communication is estimated to be around a day a week per person working. Now, that adds up to another $1.2 trillion a year in America. This is alone. So, you know, goodness knows what these numbers are if you run them out to the entire world. So that's around $10 trillion a year of cost, largely coming from poor communication, poor leadership, which is not listening to people. So listening is absolutely critical. It's profitable. It's essential. And to me, it's the foundation of all good leadership.
I like that. And it's one of those things where often, you know, it's difficult, I think, sometimes to kind of pin monetary, you know, figures to something like engagement. So that's a really interesting study that's happened there. And one of your kind of, I guess, that one of your core beliefs is that sound affects outcomes, which I think in itself is a really powerful phrase, and kind of feels like the heartbeat of your new book, Sound Effects. So how does sound actually shape relationships or influence decision making or even something like brand experience?
Well, this kind of epidemic of not listening, because the numbers show that listening is declining and has been for some time. And, you know, we can talk about the causes of that in a moment. But this numbness to sound means that we are surrounded a lot by not very pleasant and not very effective sound. And there's a kind of blasé assumption that this doesn't matter very much. But actually, and as you say, this is at the core of my book, Sound Effects, and all my work, in fact, for the last 20 years, sound profoundly affects us, even when we don't notice it, even when we are ignorant of that or just oblivious to it. And there are four ways sound affects us. First, it changes our bodies. So any sudden sound will immediately have an impact on you. It'll put you into fight flight response because, as I said, sound hearing is our primary warning sense. So anything, you know, a car backfires behind you, by the time your cortex has interpreted that and said, okay, well, that was a car, I'm not in danger, too late. Your subcortical systems have all, you know, leapt into action. We process sound 20 times faster than we process sight, especially sudden sounds.
I can say that as someone is very jumpy as well. Very jumpy person.
There's a reason for that. You know, it's self-preservation and it's genetic. It's, you know, we've been evolving for 3 million years or something like that. And we, you know, all through that time, any sudden sound is probably danger. So that's the response. So physiologically, sound changes our heart rate, breathing, hormone secretions, brain waves. Everything about our body is affected by outside sound. You know, you can calm yourself down. Sound can help or hurt always with these four ways. So you can, for example, play beautiful, gentle surf sound if you ever have a problem sleeping. And mm-hmm. that's a beautiful sound to go to sleep to. So it can help or hurt physiologically. The second way sound affects us is psychologically, changes our feelings, our mood. Mm-hmm. You only have to think of music to prove mm-hmm. that to yourself. You know, you can play a song that'll make you happy. You can play a song that'll make you sad. And it's not the only sound that changes our feelings. Actually, in 20 years of audio branding, I deployed birdsong a great deal in commercial mm-hmm. spaces. We now know that nature sound is good for us in the sense that it's relaxing, it decreases stress, and it decreases fatigue. And we put birdsong, for example, into BP service station toilets all over Europe, which were also, you know, they made them look nice. So they had vinyls of sunflowers and things like that. Mm-hmm. Customer satisfaction to the whole service station experience went up by 50%. And the birdsong was mentioned by a lot of people, because you don't expect it when you walk into a toilet. You know, and we all know service station toilets aren't necessarily the zenith of human experience.
Not a pleasant place.
Yeah, well, in this case, they were much, much more pleasant. And I think the surprise factor and the delight of, you know, experiencing nature sound in a toilet was mm-hmm. very powerful. So birdsong makes most people feel comfortable, secure. It's also a great sound to work to, by the way, because it's nature's alarm clock, time to be mm-hmm. awake. And it's a sound we've had around us ever since we've been on this planet. The birds have been here much longer than we have. Mm-hmm. So it's a sound we automatically set aside. We can work to birdsong. If you mm-hmm. put headphones on with music, that's different. Music's quite an intense signal. It's full. It's very dense, full of mm-hmm. information, and it's designed to be listened to. So in a noisy office, you might prefer with headphones on to listen to music. You're replacing one distraction with another. You'll have more mm-hmm. fun, much more pleasant, but you won't necessarily be more productive because mm-hmm. music is designed to distract and take your attention away. The third way sound affects us is cognitively, which is what I'm just coming on to there. Noisy offices are a disaster. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the areas where managers, leaders, office designers, architects I talk to a lot. I just did a talk a few months ago to 1,000 American architects about designing with the ears, because they don't. They train for 5 years. They might spend 2 days on sound. And the mm-hmm. result is noise is around us in offices, schools, hospitals, all sorts of places are not fit for purpose because mm-hmm. they are so noisy. Noise mm-hmm. is the number one problem in offices by miles, and it reduces people's productivity by up to 2/3. Now, if you're happy with your workforce being 1/3 as productive as they could be, just stick them all into an open plan office and let them get on with it. Mm-hmm. It's okay up to a point for collaboration, but even there, actually, the latest research shows a lot of people will email somebody opposite them rather than talk, because we don't like being overheard. Mm-hmm. It's intimidating. You know, we'd rather have private conversations. And in mm-hmm. open plan, there's no such thing. Plus, of course, if there's somebody behind you talking about their great night out last night, you can't think. Mm-hmm. You've only got 1.6 conversations, and the one in your head you're trying to listen to gets drowned out by this noise behind you. You have no earlids. You're programmed to language. So it's the most distracting sound of all. And mm-hmm. that is going on over millions and millions of square feet in the world. And there are millions of people whose life is miserable because they're trying to think, write, work, calculate in space which is just inappropriate. There is a movement towards a better way of doing this. It's called activity-based working, where mm-hmm. we design different types of spaces with different soundscapes, perhaps quiet working space, maybe a peaceful, serene soundscape in another one, nature sound maybe. And mm-hmm. we encourage people to go to the right space for the kind of work they want to do. That's and the kind of person they are. Because mm-hmm. we now know with neurodiversity that some people prefer different environments to be at their best when they're working. And it may be that you've got neurodiverse people who are really struggling in a noisy office. So activity-based working, a good thing. And then the final way sound affects us is it changes what we do. It changes our behavior. And there's a wonderful study, which I talk about in the book, which was done some years ago by some academics. They had two gondola end displays of wine in a supermarket, identical visual displays, French wine, German wine. And all they did was to alternate a sound condition. So on day one, a bit of French music. on day two, a bit of German music, and keep that going for weeks and weeks and weeks, alternating. Mm-hmm. So what happened? On the French music days, French wine outsold German wine by 5 bottles to 1, which may not be surprising. It does tend to sell more in the world. However, and it's a huge but, this, on the German music days, German wine outsold French wine by 2 bottles to 1. Now, that is a massive shift in consumer purchasing behavior. And interestingly, almost nobody noticed the music. This is sound influencing our behavior at a subconscious level.
Mm-hmm.
So sound affects us this powerfully. I really think we need to start listening to become more conscious about those effects and to start taking responsibility for the sound we make and the sound we consume, whether that's as a human being, in your family, in all your relationships, in everywhere you go, or as a leader of an organization where perhaps you are designing sound environments for hundreds or even thousands of people. If you're not thinking about the way the sound is affecting them, you are really doing them a disservice.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. And I guess it's kind of, it seems obvious now you're saying it, that sound affects us so kind of subconsciously with the whole kind of German, French wine kind of thing. But as soon as you say it, you're like, well, yeah, of course, you know, like you say, you have no ear lids. We're just kind of taking it all in as we go along. Now I want to ask you, actually, so you were talking about birdsong kind of being played in the background and helping productivity. So in my home office, I sit with Radio 2 on in the background all day. I deliberately don't wear headphones because I do find that distracts me. But kind of background, how is that? Is that good, bad? How might that be affecting how I'm working? Should I be playing birdsong instead? What's the deal?
I've become very careful about making broad prescriptions for people, because one of the big truths about sound, and you know, this is something which most leaders don't understand, most people don't understand actually, and it's an absolutely critical transformative realization: everybody listens differently. You know, most people make the assumption everybody listens like I do. They may not make it explicitly, but that's how we go about. So you're effectively talking to yourself the whole time, which is not wildly effective. We all listen through a set of filters, which are the culture we're born into first, the language we learn to speak, and then the values, attitudes, beliefs we pick up along the way. And then in any given situation, we might have intentions, expectations, emotions going on, and assumptions, particularly about what's going on in somebody else's head. So all of that, all of those filters create what I call a listening. So you have a listening for me right now. I'm speaking into your listening. And if I just assume you listen like I do, that's very dangerous. You're going to miss the target an awful lot. Whether it's one-to-one or you're walking onto a stage in front of 1,000 people, there's a listening you're speaking into. And it changes from person to person, audience to audience, and over time as well. Mm-hmm. It's not fixed. So, you know, when it comes to becoming responsible for the sound around you, you need to really understand your own listening. Mm-hmm. And I'm not very prescriptive about this. I mean, personally, I like silence when I'm working. Radio 2 might work really well for you. You're habituated to it, and maybe it's comforting and, you know, something that helps you to work. I'm sure there's somebody in the world who can work really well to loud death metal music. That's not me. But I've learned that making rules about this to people is very wrong, because we're all different. So I would experiment with things. You could try birdsong. I mean, if that makes you happy and productive, wonderful. Try different things and see what works for you. And that's my advice to everybody when they say things like, what sound should I have for this, that, or the other? Try certain things. The important thing is to become conscious of the sound around you. And there's an exercise in which I use now in my talks, and which I talk about in a book called Savoring. And the trick to savoring is simply, in any space that you occupy, close your eyes and taste the sound. You know, you're very careful about what you put in your mouth, and you'll spit something out if it doesn't taste good. But we're so unkind to our ears. We let them be assailed by all sorts of unpleasant sounds. So it may well be You know, if you close your eyes in any room in your house and listen, I would ask three questions. Is this sound making me happy? Mm-hmm. Is this sound healthy? And is it helpful? So three H's, happy, healthy, helpful. Is it helping me to do what I want to do in this space? You may well find that there's that buzz that's been there for years and you've ignored it for years, but it's not good for you to have constant noise like that. So maybe you can do something about it. Maybe you could put in some new sound that's really going to enhance the experience in that room, whatever it is. It might be, as I said, gentle surf in your bedroom. It might be birdsong in your workplace. I mean, I'm a big fan of nature sound. And, you know, now also because of the research showing that it's extremely good for us, as well as being productive. So that's the answer, I'm afraid, Lottie, is you have to work it out for yourself. But try different things and see what works.
I will. I absolutely will do that. I'll be experimenting with all sorts of noises coming out of my little Google speaker this afternoon. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. So to go back to sound effects, that came out 2 days before we recorded this conversation. So first of all, congratulations on that. As I said, I had a little sneak peek through the weekend and just, even just in the first few pages, completely changed the way I say, I don't think I've ever thought about sound. And now all of a sudden I'm super conscious of it. So really enjoying it so far. But for everyone else, could you maybe just give us a bit of a sense about what the book is about? And actually, was there anything that you discovered or learnt yourself whilst you were going through the writing process?
Oh, so much, yes. Well, the book is, it starts off by talking about sound and why it's important and what it is, really, because, you know, as you said, and I get this an awful lot when I do talks and podcasts and, well, anything really, people go, do you know, that's obvious, but I'd never thought of it before. This is our relationship with sound. It is suppressed. You know, it's kind of been knocked off. We don't teach children how to listen. How mad is this? You know, we teach them reading and writing, but not speaking and listening. If we taught children first how to listen, how much more of their education would they receive? And what a different world we have if everybody knew how to listen consciously. So that, I mean, that's the word I use a great deal. And that's really what the book is all about. It's closing that gap. It's bringing sound and listening back into the realm of consciousness, where at the moment it's, for most people, completely unconscious. As I just said, you know, in offices, open plan offices, there are billions of people in this world who are being damaged by the sound around them. And they're doing nothing about it because they're unconscious of that effect. Over 50% of the world live in cities. And so the book starts off by exploring what sound is and what hearing is and what listening is. I mean, how that all works, which is, I think, fascinating. And then moves on to a sort of grand tour of sound, the sound we experience and some sounds we don't experience too, starting with the sounds of our planet. So this, you know, the Earth has a great deal of sound, has had ever since it was formed, actually. And we go right back to the formation of the Earth. But when you think of sounds that many people enjoy, rain, I mean, my favorite sound of all is gentle summer rain on leaves outside the window. I think that's gorgeous. But bigger sounds, big waterfalls, crashing ocean waves, volcanoes, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, there are all sorts of thunder. You know, there are all sorts of quite big sounds that the Earth makes, and we have a tour through those. And then we go through the sounds of other living things. So geophony is the sound of the planet. Biophony is the sound of living things. And that's where I discovered so much in researching the book, from, you know, the loudest creature in the world, pound for pound, which is a tiny little snapping shrimp about the length of a digit of your finger. But when it snaps its big claw, it creates a bubble which cavitates and collapses and creates a sound that's four times louder than the loudest rock concert ever recorded at source.
Wow.
So quite a mighty little beast.
Powerful and then, shrimp.
Yeah, really powerful shrimp. And it stuns its prey by doing that. That's how it catches things. Right up to the biggest animal on this planet, the blue whale, which I find enchanting, entrancing, magical, and, you know, using the word in its proper sense, awesome. I go on a lot about language inflation and how can a pair of trainers be awesome. Well, a blue whale sound is awesome. It's subsonic. A lot of it's well below what we can hear, but even the bit we can hear, I love doing this in talks. I was just in Mexico last week talking to 6,000 people with a huge sound system and played them the sound of the blue whale, which made the whole building vibrate. It was fantastic. Wow. So it's so low. And they can communicate, or they have always been able to communicate over at least 1,500 kilometers with that low frequency sound.
Wow.
Sound travels much faster in water than in air, and much further as well. Now, sadly, due to 60,000 ships moving about at any given time, their range is reduced by 90%. And that's serious for them, because they're solitary animals and they are very spread out. And if they, if the ocean has become a kind of fog to them, they can't hear anymore. So it's harder for them to find each other, to mate, to congregate, to communicate, which I think is very sad. And then the book talks about anthropophony, the sound of us, which is not a great story, I have to say. We're a noisy bunch, and increasing numbers of us all the time, so we're getting noisier and noisier. As I said, half of us live in cities, which breaks my heart, really, because that means there's 4 billion people who never experience nature sound in any meaningful way, which, you know, we were designed for. Millions of years of evolution, it's been quite quiet. Wind, water, birds, that's what we're designed to experience. And in just a few hundred years, we've moved from that to very, very noisy urban environments, which are not what we were designed for at all. So it's not surprising there's a great deal of stress and ill health arising from that. So anthropophony, you know, obviously there are saving graces, Mozart, and beautiful sound design by a small number of people, and some real experts working in film sound, game sound, things like that. Musicians, of course, sound engineers. And I talk about the latest technology in sound in there as well. And then we move on to cosmophony, the sound of the universe. Most people think space is silent. No, it's not a vacuum. It's a very diffuse plasma, the same plasma that was there in the very beginning of the universe. And very, very low frequency sound has no problem traveling through even intergalactic space. So space is full of sound. And in the book, you can go to a website and hear some amazing sounds, like the sound of a black hole. It's shifted up so we can hear it, but it is the spookiest sound you'll ever hear, I think.
Oh, wow.
So all of those things. And then the last chapter of the book is about one of the most important sound, the sounds of all, which is silence, a sound which we've lost the relationship with hugely. And it's very important to reclaim that. So it's a paean to listening. It's a plea to listen in a world that's forgotten how. And it gives a lot of good reasons to listen, because, you know, sound is wonderful and amazing and so powerfully impacts us all. And it's really important to become conscious of that.
I love that. Thank you so much for going through that. And funnily enough, it just reminded me of a memory that I have deep down in my brain somewhere. It's when I was a kid, my grandma took me to a gift shop in Cornwall. And she said, oh, you can have one thing from the gift shop. And randomly, for whatever reason, I chose a whale song CD. that was what I wanted. And for whatever reason, that as a kid resonated with me. So maybe I'll give whale song a try this afternoon when I'm trying to figure out what is the perfect working environment for me.
Yeah, a lot of people like it. And of course, that's the song of the humpback whale you're talking about, which is fairly extraordinary. They once recorded a humpback whale singing for 23 hours. So there's a reason they sing. And, you know, I talked to my old friend David Rothenberg, who's a professor and a jazz musician, professor of philosophy and music and a jazz musician, who plays his clarinet with whales, birds, all sorts of animals. And he is absolutely adamant that animals have an aesthetic, that birds don't sing just for territory or baiting or whatever it might be. They sing because they love it. And so do whales. So very interesting. One day we'll decode these things, I'm sure. AI is working on it now. They're trying to decode the language of whales, wolves, all sorts of animals. We'll see.
Very cool. Very cool. So to a point then that you made just now on kind of being conscious of the noises that we make as human beings. When I was watching your TED talk, How to Speak So That People Will Listen, you talk about this toolbox. So thinking about things such as pace and register. And as I was watching that, I was sort of thinking a bit about authenticity. So someone like me, for example, who doesn't have a particularly low voice, I know you said that people tend to vote for politicians with a lower voice. And I am naturally a very fast speaker, as you might come to understand. So how can I and other people kind of use these tools to, for me personally, to slow down, to lower my register without becoming inauthentic or people thinking like, why has Lottie suddenly started talking like that?
Well, authenticity is very important. It's one of the four foundations I talked about in that talk of powerful speaking: honesty, authenticity, integrity, and love, by which I mean wishing people well. So I would never go to being inauthentic. But once you get that point we started with, which is you're speaking into a listening, and you're conscious of that, and you start to ask yourself the question, what's the listening I'm speaking into? You have a range, you know, you're not fixed in any particular way. You can resonate your voice, you know, higher up. I can speak very high and jolly, or I can go right down into my chest here and get much deeper. Well, anybody can do that. You can practice doing these things. Yes, it's true that we tend to assume that deep voices are more important. And there's a reason for that, that large things have deeper voices than little things. So you want to be more worried about an elephant than a mouse. And that's, again, kind of genetic. So that's come about from a very, very long experience of being on the planet and, you know, assigning significance to depth. And there is this correlation. But your voice is perfectly deep. I mean, you know, we're all given equipment we start with. I would say, you know, I'm going to be speaking to 2,000 CEOs in Copenhagen next week, and I'll ask them this question. I always do. So how many of you use your voice at work in a significant way? All of them will put hands up because they do media. They stand in front of rooms, they stand on stages. They try and inspire people. They're pitching for money from investors, all sorts of aspects. They're leading teams. So, okay, the next question is, how many of you have had formal vocal training? About three out of 2,000. I mean, and I just, what is going on, guys? If your voice is significant, this is the instrument we all play, train it, practice, go get a coach, work with a vocal coach, and you'll discover things you never knew you could do with your voice. Now, you may decide that you want to make it deeper, like Margaret Thatcher did. You know, she decided that she wanted to have more authority, and she worked with a vocal coach to pitch her voice down by at least two tones. So, I mean, that's in the book as well. And so, you know, you may decide that you want to do that. I think she ended up sounding rather inauthentic down here, you know.
Great impression.
Perhaps that's, you know, not where you want to go. But the key thing is to speak into a listening and be sensitive to that. So if you're talking to somebody who's very slow and likes to be quite measured in their delivery, and you come in and start talking like this, you'll just overwhelm them immediately. It's a question of being kind, sensitive. And the important thing is get the ball over the net. Make sure that the person can actually receive. This is a, you know, dangerous area to go into, but there's still a great deal of sexism around in boardrooms, for example, where men will talk over women or disregard what they're saying. And the female vocal range is kind of devalued, which is tragic. And some women, therefore, do work on deepening their voice in order to be more present in the kind of main traffic lanes, if you like. Well, I mean, we need to challenge all of that, of course. But it's a question of, you can't change the listening you're speaking into. You know, and people often say to me, how do I get somebody I know really doesn't listen? How do I get them to? Well, you can't just tell them you're a terrible listener. You can make appointments. You can make contracts with people, which is very powerful. So, Lottie, I've got something really important to say to you. Can you give me 5 minutes of your undivided attention? If not now, what when would be good? Tomorrow at 10, fantastic. Mm-hmm. So if I then start delivering my message and you start doing your email, I think I have a right then to say, Lottie, sorry, you did say you were going to give me 5 minutes of undivided attention. That mm-hmm. works even with somebody who is a terrible listener and always distracted. So mm-hmm. it's fair to make a contract like that. Mm-hmm. But you have to speak into the listening that you're given. You can't change other people's listening. You can change yours, mm-hmm. which is very powerful, moving your listening position around and asking, what's the best place I can listen from in this conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Which may be very different, for example, if you're listening to your son or daughter at home, five-year-old, just had a problem at school. You want to be listening from empathic listening with your heart, you know, really mm-hmm. and being with them, as opposed to somebody at home at work who's having a bit of a whinge about somebody else. And maybe you're saying, okay, what's the value in this? Can I train this person how to respond better? And you're being much more critical or evaluative in your listening position and not mm-hmm. so much from the heart. So, you know, I think what you just said is a fair question, but you have a huge range in all sorts of areas. And the reason I talk about that vocal toolbox is that most people don't know they have one. Mm-hmm. And once you become aware of the tools, like prosody, for example, let's pick one at random. Prosody, mm-hmm. the sing-song of speech, your intonation and the gaps between the words, your pacing, that's prosody, mm-hmm. prosody. Well, once you understand that that's a tool you can work on, you can practice just as you would go to a gym. So if I'm somebody who's got very monotonous prosody and really speaks on almost one note the whole time, and, you know, we mm-hmm. all know people like that, work on it, read some poetry and really, really go mad with your, you know, really exaggerate. That is exercising the muscle. So next time mm-hmm. you speak, you'll have a bit more range. And mm-hmm. that's what with volume, with prosody, with all sorts of pace, you know, you can slow right down to make an important point. Even mm-hmm. if you speak quickly, it's more dramatic if you do that. Mm-hmm. Or you can be really excited and speed right up and deliver like that. The important mm-hmm. thing is, as with everything I've said, really, this is a conversation about becoming a more conscious human being.
Mm-hmm.
Conscious of sound, its effect on me, its effect on you, its effect on the audience. Conscious of my voice, how I'm using it, conscious of my listening, where am I listening from, what listening am I speaking into. It's all about becoming a more conscious human being. And that is very, very important as a leader. You know, being a leader and sleepwalking through stuff and assuming everybody's just the same as me and they like what I like and they don't like what I don't like, it's so dangerous. You are going to piss people off, disengage them, mm-hmm. and hey, $8.8 trillion later, that's what we get.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely going to use that 5 minutes listening contracting with my husband, because I'm terrible for that. I'll just walk into a room and he'll be in the middle of doing something and I start talking and then I get irritated that he's not been listening to what I'm saying. So I'm going to start saying, hey, give me five. When can you give me five? I really Brilliant. Appreciate that.
Work.
So to go back to one of the points you made about kind of CEOs, I guess we've talked about how they can kind of use their voices very intentionally. And we've talked a lot about listening kind of on the one-to-one perspective. But in this whole disengagement study that you were talking about earlier, I think something that springs to mind is that when you are leading a business, you're often having to listen to hundreds or thousands of voices. How can you be good at listening to that many people?
I have a tool for this, which actually that came about after the book. Mm-hmm. Although I do talk in the book about some of these aspects, because there is a kind of epidemic in the world right now of being right. I definitely talk about this in the book. Mm-hmm. And it's a big problem because there's an assumption that it's all a zero-sum game. I'm right, you're wrong. It's the way it works. Or you're right, I'm wrong. Well, that's not true. Mm-hmm. Two people can be right and have very different views mm-hmm. because they're right in their own perspectives. They're right in, given their own experience, their filters, as I was talking about earlier, their belief is perfectly reasonable. Everybody does things for a reason, mm-hmm. a perfectly good reason to them. And one of the big problems with the world today, and particularly the way the internet and social media are driving us, is this extreme kind of polarization where we're making people wrong the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the tool I have for doing conflict much better and dealing with variations in people, or people we don't like, people we don't agree with, it's called PAVE. The P stands for paraphrase, which mm-hmm. is, so Lottie, what I understood you to say is this, did I get you? So mm-hmm. I'm making sure I received what you sent, which mm-hmm. is very often not the case with people who are very different or speak in a different way yeah. or have a different attitude. Sometimes we misinterpret what they said very badly.
Mm-hmm.
The A is admit. That means let it in. Let them be right. Even mm-hmm. if you fundamentally disagree with what they said, put back the outrage, you know, the commentary, the wow, the rubbish that is that's going on mm-hmm. in your head. Let that settle and let it in. Just let them be right. That means you can move on to the biggest thing I think missing in the world today, and possibly in many leaders, validation.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like, Lottie, you know what? I don't agree with what you just said, but I completely understand why you would think that.
Mm-hmm.
That's very different from, Lottie, that's crap. That's just a because, mm-hmm. you know, that the only thing that's going to result from that making you wrong like that is conflict and disconnection, mm-hmm. disengagement, you know, maybe the end of a relationship, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And having done the validation, you can then empathize, which might be, so Lottie, I get this. If that's what you believe and that's what happened, I can see why you're upset about this. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been upset about it. It wouldn't have been a problem for me. I can see why you are upset about this because you're not me. You're different.
Mm-hmm.
So paraphrase, admit, validate, empathize. It's a very powerful way of dealing with difference. And we have to do that. You know, we're now acknowledging mm-hmm. diversity in all sorts of ways in the workforce. And I think one of the most important forms of diversity in the workforce is diversity of perspective, opinion, mm-hmm. thinking. You know, if you surround yourself as a leader with clones of yourself, well, we see what's happening when you do that in America and in Russia right now. Mm-hmm. We have got leaderships in both those countries where they've surrounded themselves with yes people who just agree with them about everything. And mm. it's very fragile to have a leadership like that.
Mm.
Because if you're wrong, there's nobody to say, hang on, have you thought about this possibility or other perspective? Nobody says that. Everybody's just on the same train, heading in the same direction. And if it gets derailed, it's going to be a mess. And then, mm-hmm. you know, in the case of Trump, you know, disagree with him, you get fired. In the case of Putin, disagree with him, you get thrown out of a window. So people don't. They don't like mm. to do that. And mm. when you create that kind of, it's a monoculture of opinion, that is such a fragile way to run a business. You need mm. people who are going to say in a meeting, hang on, have you thought about this?
Yeah.
They're different. We need diversity of opinion to have a robust and powerful leadership team. So you need to be able to listen to those people, even if you don't like them, even if they're the kind of person you would never want to socialize with, you don't really enjoy their company. They could be just the most important person in that meeting because they're going to say something different. Mm-hmm. I have a friend called David Firth who wrote a great book some years ago called The Corporate Fool, which was about, you know, the old practice that kings and queens used to have of having a jester, a fool, who was the person, the one person who was allowed to take the piss out of mm-hmm. the king or queen and prick their vanity bubble, you know, and mm-hmm. bring them back to earth. That's a very important role. You know, to have people who, you know, who say, aren't we getting a little bit vain here? Aren't we getting a little bit, you know, obsessed with this one thing and so forth? So who will say the unpopular thing. Mm-hmm. So that's a very important aspect of listening is the ability to listen the difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And like you say, it's that kind of diversity of thought and opinion that helps deliver the best outcomes because you're, you know, seeing things from everyone's perspective. So we're running out of time, but I have a couple more questions for you, Julian. And in your work and kind of coaching, you've coached many leaders at kind of the very highest levels. And from what you've seen, are there any kind of communication habits that really separate effective leaders from the rest?
Yes, I mean, I think listening is the key one, listening to everybody. I don't mean that you take it all in. I don't mean you waste your whole time being passive and listening, but being able to listen to everybody. I talked to Hiram Smith, who's dead now, sadly, but he was the founder of the Franklin Covey organization with Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits guy. And he said they had an experience. I mean, he rated listening as the number one skill of a leader. And he said, that, you know, there was a guy on their production line who had an idea for a new binder. And if they hadn't listened to that guy, they would have missed a $30 million opportunity, because that's what this turned into. It was just a regular guy on the production line who said, well, what about this? Now, typically, that would be, don't get too big for your boots. Go back to work. What are you talking about? But fortunately, that guy had a leader who was a listener. So I do think conscious listening, careful conscious listening, is so critical for every leader. And then the other aspect of it is work on your voice. Go and get some vocal training, because if you want to inspire people, sell, influence, lead, your voice is critical for that. So both sides of the coin are skills. They both need to be worked on and acknowledged as important skills. And if you want to become a listening organization, that's a whole different conversation. You know, that's non-trivial. You won't get that by sending out an email saying, next week we're going to be a listening organization. No. Well, you have to consider the culture, the behaviors, the channels that are available, the way you treat people, the way you recruit, train, reward, remunerate. And it has to start from the top of the organization. We've all been in organizations with, you know, what I call dragon leaders, shouty, aggressive people who don't take bad news well. What ends up happening there is that they have no idea what's going on in their company, because nobody's giving them the bad news. And you have to know the bad news in order to know what's going on. And people start making up good news as well. I've seen that happen too. So it's very important to be open and accessible in that way.
Thank you. So for our listeners today then, myself included, is there like one daily thing that we can do to improve our speaking or our listening that we can start from today?
Well, I'll give you one for each then. So the listening practice I would recommend to everybody is to get some silence in your life. 3 minutes twice a day. Just it's like a daily dose. And the world is so noisy around us. If you can get 3 minutes of silence a couple of times a day, it might mean lock yourself in a bathroom, a closet, whatever it is. Many of us are assailed by noise the whole time, and our ears go numb. It resets your ears, recalibrates them, and it redefines your baseline for sound, because silence is the baseline. It's a very important sound. It's the gaps between the words that make everything make sense. Without silence, it's all cacophony. So that's my strong recommendation to improve your listening. Very simple, very good for you. And if you find it difficult, that is telling you you really need to do this. I know a lot of people who live in cities and go to the country and go, oh, it's so quiet, I don't like it.
Yeah.
That's a problem. Yeah. No, we really need to reestablish our relationship with silence. For speaking, I would say do the vocal warm-up exercises, which anybody can see in my TED Talk, the one on speaking, where I do them on stage. So there are exercises for the lips, the tongue, the lungs, and also for the voice. The one I will do, if I can't do any others, is the siren, which is very useful before you go on stage. You have to find a quiet place to do it in, although I do often do it while the audience are clapping for the previous speaker and I'm about to go on stage. So you go "we or," where the "we" is as high as you can go and the "or" is as low. So should we do that together, Lottie?
The dog's probably outside, like, what's going on in there?
So you can't do that in public very often, but it is very powerful. It will tend to pitch shift your voice down a little bit, and it also reveals to you any discontinuities in your voice that you can then work on simply by doing that. It lubricates and loosens you up. So that's a very powerful one to do if you have to do any public speaking.
Wait for someone else to clap and then do your little wheel on the sidelines.
Absolutely. Yep.
Love it. Well, I have one very important question for you, Julian. Do you have a favourite sound? We've talked a little bit about whales and bird songs, but have you got a personal favourite go-to?
It definitely is the sound of rain, summer rain on leaves outside a window when you're, you know, maybe lying in bed and listening to it. It's absolutely beautiful at night, the rain at night. So that's my favourite sound. And I must actually put recordings of things like that into the Listening Society, which is my online community, which I'm intending to be a force for listening in the world. Just opened its doors. I invite everybody to join. Actually, I'll send you a link giving everybody a free week to go in and test it out. So you can put that in the show notes. The Listening Society is going to have a range of beautiful sounds that you can download and use, but it's also full of research papers, research results, the podcasts I've done in the past, you know, I've recorded with people, and all sorts of aspects of sound and listening and training courses. All my training courses are in there, the ones that have trained 150,000 people. So I invite everybody to come in there, and I will put the sound of gentle rain in there forthwith, because it should be.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. Well, I'm definitely going to go and get my 3 minutes of silence later on today. But I'm also going to try, I'm going to turn off radio too. I'm going to try whale song. I'm going to try bird song. And I'm going to try, I mean, I can just open the window. We're in the UK, so it's raining a lot of the time here anyway. But thank you so, so much for your time today, Julian. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. And I hope our listeners did too. Thank you for joining us today for Aspire to Inspire. And be sure to join us again. Thank you so much, Julian.
Thank you, Bethany.
Hey. If you're getting value from today's conversation, make sure you subscribe right now so you don't miss any future episodes of the Aspire to Inspire podcast.